You're listening to the Own a Build podcast, where each week, Paul Hemming from C-Link interviews experts on how small and medium-sized developers can level up their business through intelligent construction management.
Hello, and welcome to episode 22 of the Own a Build podcast with me, Paul Hemming. And Liam Curley. Oh, hang on a minute. He's not here again. Curls is always on holiday. I'd like to run a competition, in fact, to see if anyone, any listeners know of anyone who's on more holidays than Curls. So it's either that or he's had a pretty big fallout with our guest, as it just seems that he always times being on holiday whenever Pyragash is here. How are you doing, Pyragash?
I'm very well. I think now's the time to reveal to you, to be honest, is Liam and I are actually the same people.
Oh, so Liam was, that makes sense. Because Liam, you're a big fan of, from what I understand, talking to you offline, you're a big fan of model villages. And is that
of course, yes. The truth is out.
Yeah, so you had a lovely, lovely weekend away in Boughton on the Water in the Cotswolds, did you, Pyragash?
Yes, I did. Fantastic.
Very upsetting to hear that you didn't go to the model village there, because I'm a big fan.
And I wish I'd known that. Then I could have visited with you.
The only place where I feel like a giant. So anyway, as a lot of the listeners will know, Pyragash is the best friend of the Own the Build podcast. And in my opinion, he needs no introduction. But for anyone who is new, Pyragash is the founder of Totem Finance, an FCA-regulated brokerage and debt advisor. He's a genuine expert on all things development finance, and we're always delighted to have him on the show. So much so that he, as he always does, he even comes up with the titles of the episode. So today is Swimming with Sharks. I'd love to take the credit for the episode name, but it was all Pyragash. So let's jump into it. The topic and the title Swimming with Sharks kind of comes from a conversation that I was having with not actually a client of ours, but an SME developer who I know pretty well, got a very good relationship with him. And I won't name any names, but he was mentioning that he is using mezzanine finance company to fund the project that he is working on. The project is a few months late in construction. I think it's 2 or 3 months late. And he has suffered a 250k penalty as a result of that delay, on top of circa 27% interest that he's paying on the loan. And in his words, he said to me, Pyragash, he feels like he's being he's in a relationship with a loan shark. So I have two questions. The first one, let's keep it simple. What on earth is mezzanine finance?
Okay, so... So mezzanine, just like, you know, for those of us that or listeners that are sort of more visual, it is just like the mezzanine floor in a building. It sits above the rest of the building. And in terms of lending, that means that you sit behind the senior lender. So if the first charge lender is, say, lending £100, the mezzanine lender may lend, say, just £10, but they crucially sit behind. And the effect of mezzanine is to reduce the amount of equity that you would put in. But because they sit behind the senior, and what I mean by that is that if, for example, you want to repossess a site, as the mezz lender, you can jump up and down and say, oh, this is all going wrong, I want to repossess. But unless the senior lender agrees and actually goes ahead and repossesses, you just sit there. And so although your risk profiles are different, your opportunity to manage the project is different as well, which is typically why they can be more expensive and certainly eye-wateringly expensive.
Okay, excellent. Well, a brilliant analogy for us construction folk there, so I'll take that. And then my second question, ignore the inflammatory use of the word loan shark, but is the story that I explained to you the sort of story that you hear often?
I think, you know, putting aside this particular case, because obviously, you know, I don't know all the details, I think what's important to note first is, you know, if you're entering into a contractual relationship with a mezzanine funder who's maybe charging between 15 and 22%, I mean, that's eye-watering interest rates, right? It's cheaper than equity, but it's eye-watering debt rates. They're obviously charging a lot more than the senior lender. You've got to kind of understand where...
Why obviously? Sorry.
Sorry. So I say obviously because, just like I said before, the mezzanine lender is taking a very different risk position. So, you know, the senior lender is paid first. So if the project goes wrong, but up to a certain point, the senior lender is fine. So to give you some context, let's just say I had a house that was, the end sales value is 600K. The senior lender lends 450 grand. And the mez lent, say, 100 grand on top of that, and that's it. So 450 plus 550, but you end up selling it at 500 grand. Clearly, the senior lender is always fine in that scenario. And because of that loss given default or loss given repossession, that's likely they will naturally charge more. Because in a group of loans, if 12 go wrong, clearly that means they're going to have a greater degree of loss. And so as a result, they've got to charge more to kind of compensate for that. So that's why they tend to be more expensive. But this comes down to understanding who you're dealing with. And it also smacks of understanding that when you move away from the high street banks or FCA regulated lenders, for example, you are now entering, you know, you were, to use the swimming with sharks analogy, you know, you were fishing in your nice little pond that you knew down the back of the garden, but you're now in the deep ocean. And there's lots of different type of fish who eat lots of different types of things. And so you're dealing with a lender who has a completely different perspective on life. So some of them are very, very small lenders. Maybe their pot of cash is only 1 million or 2 million. And when they give you 500 grand or 100 grand, that forms a really large percentage of the money they have. So when they make a decision around, okay, this is now taking longer than we expected, they're worried about losses, maybe. So that's why they're effectively making slightly different decisions than you would a senior lender. Senior lender has bags of cash, is just wanting to ensure that there's no losses, and tend to act in a way that's perhaps more reasonable. But that's because you've almost got to think of the mezzanine lender in some instances as you're lending their own money, their physical money. That, you know, they can't now go and invest in another project because of you. Maybe they've got their own personal stuff going on, and they need cash to finish on their own property project. You know, all of these things impact the way in which they act.
And so, and therefore, to have the default charge is just their way of recovering some of their risk.
Yeah. So what I would add, what I think is happening in this particular scenario is you've also got to understand how they are funded. So the mezz funder, if it's not using their own cash, they may be sourcing funding from investors. Now, investor money generally, as you've seen or people may have heard, you get open and closed funds. So open fund means you can invest and you can take your money out whenever you want. Closed funds tends to be that you agree to put the money away for a period of time and then you get paid back. Now, when you take your money off investors, typically they might say, yeah, we'll give you this for, I don't know, say 12% per annum, but we expect the money after a year. Now, if the money doesn't come back after a year, it poses two problems. Number one, the lender themselves may have a penalty, but the bigger issue is this, that they may lose the confidence of their funding line. So now let's look at what's happening. You're a developer looking to do your project with your own issues, and all you want is to build this project. But the mezzanine funder is managing a couple of things. Yes, they want to make sure there's no losses on your project, but for your one project, if they were to go over and not deliver an enhanced return, they could lose their funding line. And if they lose their funding line, that's their business gone. So now we're dealing with more than just your project, because the lender has their own issues. And the reason why this is so important is that as a property developer, you know, the FCA very much see you as a big boy. You know, you're doing your own business. And so you should be able to understand who you enter into a contract with. At its most basic, whether that's a contractor who maybe has a dodgy balance sheet or a really bad credit rating behind him, you know, no point signing a contract with them and then realizing, you know what, they've got no cash flow and they're constantly having their own issues. And just like that, with a funder, you've got to understand
who you're getting into bed with.
who are you getting into bed with, and on what terms are you getting into bed with? You know, if you're looking at a project and you're thinking, yeah, I think it's 12 months, but a couple of things could go wrong and this could easily be 15. My question is why don't you pay for 15 up front? Right? The first thing. The second thing is, if you do want that flexibility, ask them, you know, what are the terms upon which we can seek an extension and when, if that's important to you? You know, there are so many.
You'd think it should be important to a lot of developers, though, right? Because we talked on one of our last podcasts about the volume of construction projects that overrun. I think it was 80%, wasn't it, in that MACE analysis that they did of all UK or infrastructure projects. So almost all projects overrun. So having that hard and fast line as soon as you're in delay, there's a big penalty. It's something you've got to very much consider at the outset, right?
And then, of course, you know, as a broker, what we would be saying, you know, plug for us, is we would look at, you know, maybe the slightly more costly option, but that would offer you 15 months, or would do it as a fee to start off with, so you know from the outset, actually, it might be worth a little bit more. I know we're already expensive, but it may be cheap, it may be beneficial to pay a little bit more for a slightly longer period, or the ability to have a longer period because you can sleep at night. You know, these are the push and pull points that need to be considered.
I guess also the developers then got to consider, if they don't do that, if they go for the expensive or the option with the 250k penalty charge, that penalty charge then in some way needs to find its way down into the contractor's contract, so that the contractor is equally vested in trying to get everything done in 12 months. There are a lot of questions, and we're not going to get into, I guess, like the particulars of this particular case because we don't understand it, we don't know it, but I totally understand what you're saying. It sounds like mezzanine finance is a way of topping up. It's not like your traditional route. What's the reason? Why would I have to procure mezzanine finance?
Predominantly, it's because you don't have enough cash to complete the project otherwise. You know, there's a funding gap between what the senior lender will give you and how much equity or cash that you have to complete. So it's a question of how are you going to fill that? Now, most people are loath. So let's just talk about that last example. You know, you might only need 5% of costs or 10% of costs to be funded by your mezzanine. Many people are loath to get that from equity and then end up sharing 30% of the profits. So instead, they think, oh, yeah, mezzanine, that's a good way to plug the gap. And sometimes it can be. You know, sometimes pairing mezzanine with a cheaper senior lender is cheaper on a blended basis than going with just one senior lender. But one thing that I really want the listeners to grasp is that, and you made the point, sometimes the only option is to take this mezzanine. That, you know, there isn't an option to find somebody else that'll do it longer. There isn't an option to get an extension agreed up front. So sometimes this is all you're at. And what I would say in that scenario is make sure that your communication levels with the lender is spot on. So it's never a surprise what's happened. You know, if you have an early issue, you start communicating with your lender immediately. You know, why, under what conditions could this then impact the extension, but you're going to do X, Y, and Z to keep it in. And so you keep speaking, and just seed.
So if it says it in the contract and you're with a mezzanine finance company of the nature that you described, who are very delicately poised financially themselves, yeah. It doesn't matter if you communicate well.
I don't think that's completely true. I agree that if they're in a precarious position, they're in a precarious position. However, goodwill goes a long way, I still believe. And you give yourself every chance.
Because you're a good guy, you are up here.
Well, you know, but I believe that you give yourself every chance by communicating in the right way, by ensuring that every report is on time, by engaging, you know, what does it mean for you? Actually show concern, you know, right. So if this slips by a couple of weeks, how are we going to be? Can we start communicating with your funding line? You know, what is it that we can do to show that we're right on it? Because when it comes to it, if 3 months beforehand, they're going to say, look, we can see that this is going to slip. And by the way, the borrower has been good as gold. They've absolutely nailed every single thing that they should be doing. They've also done this for their own pain. They're not just transferring all of the risk onto us. And we're really comfortable that, so for example, let's just say you can see things are going to get delayed, but you've got an off-plan sale agreed. So you've offset some of the risk at the same time. I'm not saying it's a definite that they're going to go, woohoo, great, you know, but they've got something to go with as well, and to say, these are one of our good borrowers. This sort of thing does happen, but they're one of our good borrowers, and we'd like to not penalize them completely. We'd like to do X, Y, and Z, and they've constantly been feeding with us. And look, it still may not mean that they still might smile at you, say, thank you so much. We're still whacking on the big fee, right?
Yeah. But it's a way of managing expectations, a way of managing people. We've talked about that a lot before. That's I totally understand that. And it's really interesting. What I want to talk to you about next, and we're going to do it after the break, is kind of what the red flags are for you as a broker, if you like. But we'll talk about that just after this break now.
I wanted to take a quick break from the show to share a message from our sponsor, Seelink. Seelink is software designed to streamline the process of subcontract procurement. It's a platform that helps SME developers and main contractors stay agile whilst replicating the commercial scale and savvy of large contractors. If you want to save a guaranteed minimum 5% against budget construction costs on your next project, head to www.get.c-link.com/podcast to find out more. If you're driving or working out right now and didn't catch that URL, don't sweat it. We've included the link in the description box for this episode. Now, let's get back to the show.
Okay, so my question to you now, Pirogash, is you kind of touched on it in the first part there, where if you were acting on behalf of a developer, giving them various different options about mezzanine finance or whatever kind of development finance they were entering into, there would be certain things, i.e. a 250k penalty charge if you're 3 months late or if you're 1 month late, that to you in your role you would say, I have to flag this. This is a big concern, it's a big risk. I have to flag this as this. These are the pros and cons of the two different routes. What should you be looking for? What are the red flags to you when you're analyzing development finance options?
There's lots of stuff. I think at the outset, I think you want to understand what kind of experience the lender has in what they're doing. So what does their book look like? You will also get a sense of, I would say, as a developer, you will have certain technical expertise. I would be pushing the first meeting that you have with the development lender is to start to ask them questions around, so what happens in, you know, when you have this difficulty, that difficulty, the sorts of stuff that you deal with every day on site, how are they going to be impacting? And I think if the person you're speaking to, and it may be that you need to speak to the underwriter, can literally is scared at everything that you're saying, that, you know, that's a warning sign. And
when you say scared, do you mean
like just unsure about what do you mean that? Yeah, you know, what do you mean there can be a cost overrun? What do you mean that there'll be a delay because of this and that? What sewage can be a problem, you know? And it's just trying to understand in detail. We once came across a foreign lender, you know, had bags of cash, wanting to get involved, and we asked some of these questions, and it became very clear that they had the money, but they were going to rely on a set of professionals to really respond on all these, whether it was the solicitor, the PMS or whatever. And while a reliance on professionals is healthy, it should only ever be support, because ultimately the credit decision should be informed by the person with the experience at the lender. So that's one of those, you know, how many loans have they done of this type? How comfortable are they with the traditional structures? What we tend to do is whenever we get the loan agreement, we run through it with the developer, and we just talk through what we would normally expect to see, or if there's something that's not mentioned. So for example, what happens if, you know, there is a cost overrun, there's no reference to that. What, or if there's a particular set of covenants that we think, how's that going to work in practice? Like, for example, we were looking at something recently, and it turned out to be a bit of a non-point, but it was talking about very early on, if the reserve matters weren't dealt with, the interest would start to be serviced. And we looked at that, and because there wasn't really any land loan, we said, well, this doesn't make sense. And it is literally that kind of common sense view of, these are all a whole bunch of words, but what is the commonality? What is the real wording? What does this really mean?
How does it make you feel? What's it going to make you do?
What's it going to make you do? So, you know, and then we pushed back and it was fine. It was taken out. So, you know, it is sort of understanding, you know, what is the classic one is, there's an amount of a loan and there's just a loan. And it says, you know, we will agree that, you know, drawdown can happen based on proper costs, etc. And I'm like, well, that's really variable. Wouldn't it be better to have an agreed budget with the lines? So classic sensitivities are things like VAT. You know, not all lenders will fund VAT. Then there's also costs like, what am I thinking about now? So for example, if the developer has a development management fee to feed the salaries internally, right? Sometimes that can be considered an equity release. You know, it's that you should be paid at the end.
If it's paying the directors effectively.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas if that's important to you, put it in black and white, have it there, have it added up so that it's very clear what you're drawing against, so that there's no ambiguity. You know, sometimes ambiguity, because you don't have control as a developer, works against you every time. You know, if you're like, oh, that sounds okay. Or the classic one I love from some lenders is, yeah, I know it says that, but we'll never actually do it.
Same when you're a contractor, and there's, or in my case, I was a subcontractor, and you're reading all these terrible clauses of what's going to happen to you in the event of there being an issue. Yeah, but that's never going to happen, is it? So sign it or forget it, and you think, well, just it doesn't
wipe
feel
it in there.
Right.
And I think it's a really important point you make there, which is, if it's in the contract, it's there for a reason. Yes, it might be a completely unlikely scenario, but let's just take the last 15 years. We've had the biggest financial crisis we've ever had. We've had the UK leaving a previous member state that it was always going to be part of. We've had a pandemic, which, you know, like we've never seen across the world. So stuff happens.
I was going to use another word there, but yeah, it does happen.
I was going to use another word, which I think everyone can guess, but, you know, we try and keep this PG. And it's really, really important in that scenario that you really just work through the rationale, what's going to happen. You know, simple things like, I've got to repay, what happens if I don't? How flexible can they be and why? What are their pinch points? What are the lender's pinch points? What are their motivations? So another classic thing is, if a lender is purely doing development finance and that's it, often I see that as a good sign, because they're not going to suddenly say, we don't like the development finance sector, we're going to go into hotels. Well, they're not going to do that because they like development finance. This is what they do. So they're either going to lend or they're just going to close up shop. So that gives me an element.
And they understand
confidence.
It as well.
Yeah, and they understand it, exactly. So, and then it's like, well, what is their motivation? Are they a lender or are they loaning to own? So this is going back to the shark point. And some people will lend money and give you enough rope to hang yourself, because they will then charge a whole load of fees, repossess the site, and really they get to then own the site. And through all the incidental fees and all that kind of stuff, end up basically taking a lot of the profits from the site. So, you know, these are the sort of questions. Hopefully they're fairly common sense. You know, like I've said before, lending, borrowing, it can be more complex than it actually is. You know, keep it simple, stupid.
I think running a business, going through rounds of investment myself, where I've had the emotion of knowing the end goal, the plan of what you're trying to achieve, versus the reality of funding, needing funding, and having it's a means to an end, but it's much more than that, as I've come to understand in the years of running C-Link. But I don't know if this is the same for developers, but I imagine it feels the same, is that you think, I really need this, otherwise X, Y, and Z doesn't happen, which basically means nothing happens. So it's easier to think, well, it's probably not going to happen, so fine, I'll sign that. Because if I don't sign it, I'm not doing anything. So obviously you're advising loads of people who are going through those emotions. how do you balance it? Because that's the thing. You think, well, they've got what I need, so I've kind of got to suck it up, is sometimes maybe how people feel.
So our approach is always, it's not, we start with not can we fund the deal. We don't start with that, because often the answer is yes, we can. But, you know, the question then is the risk that you're taking on. And it's different for different people. So with developers that are super experienced, that really know what they're doing, it's a slightly different approach because of the experience that they bring in. But especially for newbies, and when I say newbies, it could be main contractors that are making the step up, it could be professionals that are making the step up. It's much more nuanced, and it's about saying, do you really have to do this deal? I mean, I've got a client that we are probably a couple of weeks off doing our first deal, but I first met them 3.5-4 years ago, and I spent the first year and a half saying, don't do this deal, don't do this deal, don't do this deal. And, or, you know, I fully respect the fact that as entrepreneurs, they have more entrepreneurial spirit and can appreciate the risk they take. But it's my job to kind of, to be the sobering test, you know, to kind of say, actually, only this, this, or this needs to happen in order for this to become really difficult. You know, is this the one that you want to, you know, risk your home on, you know, that you want to risk, you know, your income on, your reputation, everything else.
Your sanity, yeah.
Exactly. And the deals that we do, and sometimes the entrepreneur will disagree, and that's okay. Because in the end, just like you, Paul, you know, when you're raising money for your business, the buck stops with you. We're only an advisor, but that's how we try and get it right, is by focusing on making sure it's the best structure, that it's the most stable structure, and that it's really going to work. And then if stuff happens, and we'll deal with it. But at least we start from a solid base, and we start from a point that our eyes are open. So if we're going to take on a risky deal, we know it's risky from day one, because what that does is it hones all of your other senses to realize that you can't give 1 or 2% to the contractor here. You can't slip up here. You can't slip
one
up
or
there.
2 weeks or whatever.
Yeah, you're much tighter with your project manager. All of those things. You may have to look at construction management versus typical JCT.
Now we're talking.
Yeah, exactly, right? Because you have to shift. You have to figure out. You've taken this risk on at the start from a funding perspective, so you can't then load risk across the whole project. You've got to de-risk it as you're going along.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's going back to that example, construction-wise, is if you do have those penalties in and you know exactly what it means, and you do say, I'm the entrepreneur, I want to take on this deal because that's the risk profile I want to take on, and you say, fine, that's okay. But I guess it's still understanding that penalty exists and it's going to hurt and it's going to hit. So you've got to be aware of that and manage that down your supply chain as well, theoretically, with contractors and whoever else, because it's a risk profile you've accepted. And I think maybe sometimes, from what my understanding of this is that people take risks without specifically knowing that risk and then specifically knowing how to manage that risk, which is why I was asking you about those red flags. What are the things that stick out to you that you should say, oh, crikey, they've got to know about that and they've got to manage it? It sounds like it's the experience of the lender. It's the lender's pinch points. It's what happens if there's a delay, what happens if there's a cost overrun, all things that we know happen in development, and understanding those and being able to then know what your trigger points are and how to manage them. And also, as always, Pirogash, having good quality conversations, early notifications, and all of those things.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
It's funny, you know, I come into these conversations with you. I always have a fixed agenda of what I think is going to happen. And I came in here thinking, these mezzanine finance guys, we are swimming with sharks here, but you've completely changed my opinion that it's, because there's such an array of options to the development finance, yes, there is different lenders with different profiles of risk, and therefore they will transfer that in a different way. You, as the developer, still do have absolute control to say, I'm entering that deal or I'm not entering that deal. And if I am entering that deal, I'm doing it full knowledge that it's going to present me big risk, and then I have to manage that risk, not just say, these are the only options I've got, sign on the dotted line.
Exactly.
What a man. What a man Pierre Gash is. I mean, he's the gift that never stops giving. As always, fascinating insight. We managed to make every dry-seeming topic really, really interesting. And I personally very much enjoyed that. And as we've started doing now, I'd be very happy to hear from any of the listeners. If you have any questions, if you've want to say hello, if you've spotted curls sunbathing on a beach somewhere, then just drop us a line, let us know. We'd love to hear from you. My email's paul@c-link.com. And yeah, goodbye from me, and I'll see you soon, Pierre Gash.
Thanks very much. Cheers.
Cheers, mate. Take it easy. Bye-bye.